Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Underwear, armpit hair, many imitators, but no one compares.
Badass Women's Hour XL with Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell and Emma Sexton on Talk Radio.
One, two, three, four!
Welcome to the Badass Women's Hour podcast with me, Harriet Minter. This week, I'm joined by MP Rosie Duffield to talk about representation in politics. I meet Claire Seal, aka My Frugal Year, who's coming back from 27 grand's worth of debt, live on Instagram. And we learn why women are not prioritised in healthcare.
Now, if you were watching Prime Minister's Questions this week, you might have seen Rosie Duffield challenging Boris Johnson on why there were so few women standing at that lectern on the daily parliamentary briefings talking about what is going on with the coronavirus. I think it's only been Priti Patel who has done it. We've got a little clip of her talking to him here.
Women make up the vast majority of the workforce in our NHS, social care sector and our schools. However, there's only a handful of women on the SAGE committee, and only one woman in the Cabinet has led the Downing Street briefing in the last 8 weeks on a very few occasions. Does the Prime Minister agree with me, as the chair of the largest group of female MPs in this House, that we need a change of tone and more female voices at the top of government to reflect the majority of the UK population, almost 52% of whom are in fact women? And if not, why not?
That was Rosie Duffield there challenging Boris on the lack of women fronting the parliamentary briefings on COVID-19. She joins us now. Hi, Rosie.
Hello, Harriet. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. Thank you so much for talking to us this evening.
Okay.
Everyone listening there will have heard, you know, you've quite rightly saying there's only been one woman in the last 8 weeks actually fronting it, which is Priti Patel. And yeah. I think we all saw when she's done it, she's been taken apart afterwards. Why do you think it's important that there are more women? Does it matter?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, like I said in my question, more people are women, 52% almost of the UK population. So the question really for me is, why not? You know, what possible reason could it be that we're only seeing men? You know, sometimes on panel shows, on TV, whether it's comedy or politics, there's kind of one token woman. Still, it's 2020, you know, we're really gaining seats in the House of Commons, but yet we're not seeing that reflected. And interestingly, the day that I asked my question, Girl Guiding published a report saying that 60% of girls aged 15 to 18 haven't seen positive women leaders during the crisis at all. So, you know, that's a really crappy message actually to young women and girls who are wanting to come into the public eye or into politics in that way.
It is, I understand what you're saying, which is we need role models and we need to see ourselves represented in parliament ourselves. We need to see young women, need to see older women doing those big jobs to believe that it is possible for them to do it too.
Yeah.
But do you think there is an actual direct impact on women because we do not have enough women, for example, sitting on SAGE, because we don't have enough women feeding in at cabinet level into the strategy around coronavirus?
Yeah, I really do. I mean, when I was growing up, I watched people like Harriet Harman and Diane Abbott, and I knew that women could do that. It was just sort of a thing, you know, it was quite exciting actually to see them there on, you know, on the television all the time, every day. And although, you know, not my politics, but Mrs. Thatcher was leading the country, she was a female prime minister. And I think if you do see that directly, it becomes more possible, not just a sort of distant dream. And, you know, look at the other countries. I think it was Madeleine Albright in The Economist who said the women, you know, the countries that are dealing with the coronavirus crisis really well are actually led by women. You know, we need to get that sort of direct correlation between young women and girls, and that that's a possibility, instead of everyone just watching X Factor and dreaming about doing those kind of things, which, of course, is, you know, pretty valid in a way, but not very realistic. Women need to have a say and a place at the table.
Why do you think it is that some of those countries that appear to be doing better at pushing back COVID-19 are led by women? Do you think there is a gender aspect in the leadership there?
Possibly, yeah. I mean, most of the key workers involved in frontline healthcare are still women, you know, teaching assistants, teachers, people sort of on the ground, if you like. You know, obviously there are men directly affected and more men are suffering and actually, unfortunately, dying. But women are there as nurses and, you know, advisors and counsellors and cleaners and care workers. And we're seeing those people in their homes directly and on the front line. And, you know, surely that knowledge gained and that experience is really important.
And also it strikes me that actually if you have people in Parliament who have come from those professions, if you have women who have been nurses or care workers who have then gone into government, they have a direct experience of what that's like. But
absolutely.
To do that, we have to show them it's possible, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the title of your show directly relates to, you know, I would say my friend Dr. Rosenna, who is just one of those women who is on the front line and doing an incredible job. You know, she's a mum to young children. She's out there doing sort of local politics, looking after her constituents, but she's also actually saving lives at the Nightingale and at St. George's in Tooting. So, you know, and we've got a few MPs who, I was a teaching assistant, Maria Caulfield in the Conservatives was a nurse. You know, that really does, it should be something that sort of is feeding into the policy here and the experience of teachers who are out there, you know, pretty much on their knees at the moment.
One of the other things I think is interesting is what happens to wider policy while coronavirus is sort of dominating everything.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking, for example, about the gender pay gap reporting, which has been sort of quite quietly dropped and nobody has to do it now after we fought for it so long. Do you think there are other things like that which are sort of disappearing into the ether because we don't have enough women at the top level fighting for them?
Yeah, very much so. I think there's an awful lot around the domestic violence bill. Although we've had that come back, there are so many offshoots of things to do with that that we could get through Parliament. You know, gender pay is a huge example, actually, isn't it? Because Theresa May was really pushing on that, you know, getting companies to kind of admit, you know, their pay gap policy and things and their statistics. And then that's just kind of gone quiet. I mean, there's things like the no-fault divorce system that David Gawk was introducing before he lost his seat and stood down. But yeah, I mean, all of those kinds of things do have direct effect on women's lived lives, and we're just ignoring them all. And we've got to at the moment, I'm afraid, but we need them to come back.
Well, that's interesting, though, because do you think we have to ignore them? This is the thing that I find an interesting question within the whole of the COVID-19 policymaking, which is things like if we ignore the gender pay gap reporting, for example, then what we're also going to be looking at is probably that we know when companies make large rounds of redundancies that women are more likely to be made redundant because they're more likely to be in part-time work. They're more likely to say, well, actually, if I can take some money, I can go and home and look after my kids and maybe I should do that. They sort of feel a level of pressure to it. And we won't, will we be able to put that reporting back in place, or will we be back where we were 10 years ago when we were fighting for that to happen?
I really hope we can come back with that. It's just that sort of almost everything has had to be ignored. You know, I wish that wasn't the case, but it's a bit like during Brexit. We only had one or two bills going through the House, you know, literally, because everything was about Brexit policy and all the things that were spinning off from that. And I suppose it's the same with coronavirus. It just feels like so many important things have been on hold for so long. But, you know, when people like Harriet Harman and Stella Creasy and Yvette Cooper and, you know, the women's PLP certainly are there, we're going to push and push and push to get that through. And hopefully the chief whips will be able to negotiate something to get some of these really important things. But yeah, I think you're right. When we see, you know, the other side of the coronavirus, we're going to have women really badly affected. And I think there's going to be some unscrupulous employers who take advantage of that, sadly.
How is government at the moment, as a virtual government, how are you finding it being a virtual MP?
Do you know what? I mean, I was really worried at first, and my colleagues were, but we've all adapted really well. I mean, there was a Conservative MP this week who sort of started saying that we're all lazy and we don't go back to work. We are, I mean, I certainly am working just as hard, if not harder, just not getting as much physical exercise doing it, sadly, walking around the whole of Westminster and the estate. But we're doing surgeries virtually. We're doing, you know, 6 or 7 Zooms. I'm doing my select committee, the EFRA select committee. We're doing letters with our teams and meetings with our teams, all of the things that we would do normally, actually. And I've been in the chamber a couple of times and I know it's sort of safe. So it doesn't feel that different. I'm just missing my colleagues and the social aspect, really.
Obviously, today the big news that everyone is reporting on is that Dominic Cummings was found to have broken lockdown whilst his boss was very strongly telling everyone to obey it. Do you think he should resign?
Personally, I really absolutely have always stayed away from making personal statements about individuals. He's not an elected member of parliament. And it's kind of none of my business in a way what Boris Johnson does with his staff. But, you know, I think it just goes to show actually that these messages are so easily interpreted and misinterpreted because they have been so kind of vague and woolly and, you know, these kind of messages.
Do you think
like
that's the case? We were in a time at that place where, you know, the message was stay home. It was very clear. It wasn't even stay alert. It was stay home.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, MPs interpreted it that way, but I still had hundreds of messages and people phoning in the office saying, I'm not sure, how about this? You know, I think people did find it really, really hard to completely understand it, you know, sort of in accordance with their particular situation. So,
but do you think the guy who created it should find it hard to understand?
No.
Is that where we're at? We're actually so impossible that if you created it, you didn't even know what it was.
No, of course not. But I mean, I don't know his personal circumstances and I haven't had an ill 4-year-old during this. And, I don't want to judge him too much. That is a matter for the Prime Minister, really. But it's not a great look, is it?
It's not a great look. You're quite right. Rosie, thank you so much for joining us. Rosie Duffield, MP, there talking about why it is that we need to have some women standing at the front of those daily briefings. They're actually, and I find this all the time, and I've said it before on the show, that there's a reason why perhaps certain minorities in this country are disengaged from those briefings because it is lots of white men, never mind just women. I don't think I've seen more than 1 or 2 people of colour in any of those briefings. Why is that? Why is it so impossible for us to find anyone who isn't a white man in a senior position somewhere? Very good point raised by Rosie Duffield in Parliament this week. One that the Prime Minister says he is taking on. He says we've got some senior women from business who are going to come in and help. So maybe they'll be showing up at some of the briefings and telling us what's going on. Is it going to make a difference, though? I don't know. I'd love to know what you think. Do you think we need more women at the front of the daily government briefings? Or is it just tokenism? That is what MP Liz Truss said today. She said it's just tokenism. If they're there for the sake of it, it's not. Just tokenism shouldn't happen.
This is the Badass Women's Hour podcast.
Welcome back to Badass Women's Hour. It's with me, Harriet Minter, here on Talk Radio, and my guest, Claire Seal, author of Real Life Money and Control Your Finances, also better known as My Frugal Year on Instagram, where she has amassed thousands of followers as she charts her way back from debt. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Harriet.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight. For anyone who doesn't follow you and doesn't know your story, tell us a little bit about how you came to start an Instagram account that has grown to be such a success.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was never, it's been a bit of a whirlwind year. It was never intended to sort of become the community that it has. Really, for me, it was a way of sort of channeling some of the feelings that I was having around money and our situation, which was that in March of last year, after kind of a few years of real head in the sand and not managing money very well, we had accrued about £27,000 worth of debt, which is spread across a few different credit cards and an overdraft. And it was just, it was a sort of joint, like, breaking point and turning point, I suppose. And I really felt like I needed a bit of an external vessel to channel some of the sort of emotional side of money, which isn't really spoken about that much, into. But I really just thought I would get maybe like a couple of dozen followers who might shout at me if I spent too much money. I never foresaw any of this.
What was it for you? Was it about the accountability, or I guess what was your motivation behind it? Did you think, what were you hoping it would give you?
I think I really wanted something where I could track my progress. And I sort of had seen a couple of things of different people starting to just talk about money, women on Instagram, and Alex Steadman, who is the Frugality, being one of them. She wrote a great article about her relationship with money on her blog, and I just part of it felt poetic as well, because Instagram had been such a trigger for real, like, emotional overspending for me, that to sort of put my personal account aside and start something completely new with, you know, the focus of undoing that damage felt quite good.
When you talk about Instagram being a trigger, do you know, because one of the things that I love about your account is that you're really honest about the emotional side of spending and how we get ourselves into debt and why that happens. Can you tell us a little bit about, I guess, what you've learned about your own spending habits and what you've had to adapt as you've been running this account?
Yeah, I mean, I really was trapped in quite a vicious circle of, you know, spending more than I could afford, then feeling anxious about that. And then anxiety has always been a really big spending trigger for me, because I think for a lot of people, and a lot of women especially, if you're feeling really anxious, you can sort of imagine that there is something that you might be able to buy in order to solve that problem, whatever, you know, or just even a distraction. You know, the kind of phrase retail therapy has been around for years, and I've only ever heard it applied to women. And I think that kind of sort of very light attitude to spending is really perpetuated on Instagram as well. You know, a lot of people have like shopaholic in their Instagram bio. And obviously there's an awful lot of advertising, more and more advertising. So I really had to begin with, just sort of unfollow and unsubscribe to a lot of the accounts and sort of email newsletters that were a bit of a trigger for me, and to just try and sort of break that cycle of emotional spending that I knew that I had been really trapped in, by sort of giving myself more time before purchases, putting in some, like, adding in some questions of, you know, what is the problem that I've got? Am I trying to solve that problem by buying this thing? And is this thing going to solve my problem? But, you know, it doesn't happen overnight.
It definitely doesn't. You've got lots of great tips on your account. You gave us one there, thinking about how we put time in between seeing something and purchasing it. That is a very big thing for me. I know that if I can wait more than about 5 minutes, my desire to purchase it goes right down and I probably forget about it. But that 5 minutes can feel like a lifetime sometimes. We're going to keep talking to Claire about some of her tips for managing money and what she's learned, and her new book. That's here on Badass Women's Hour XL.
This is the Badass Women's Hour podcast. You can get in touch on all the socials on @BadassWomen's Hour.
Claire, one of the things that I've really connected with on your Instagram account and that really spoke to me was your sort of struggle and honesty around the shame that debt can bring with it. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, when I first started the account, it's been sort of quite key to note, I was anonymous until really quite recently. And a big reason for that in the beginning was that I felt really ashamed. You know, I have always felt like I'm quite bright. I'm actually really quite good at maths. And I felt that, you know, it was not a situation that I should find myself in. And I think that, you know, the shame is very much mirrored by a lot of judgment from society about people with debt and assumptions about their character, which I think is really difficult for people. I think that a lot of people like me feel like if they were to be open about their financial situation, that people might think less of them. People might make the assumption that they're irresponsible or silly or materialistic. And, you know, it just really isn't the case. I think it's really difficult to get over that shame. And the reason why it took me sort of a year to put my own name and my face to my account was that it took me that time to sort of get my ducks in a row and be open, you know, start to open up to my friends and family and to really overcome that shame. And, you know, the Instagram account was a huge part of that for me, because when I started opening up, I started getting messages from lots of people in the exact same position. And I think one of the key things for overcoming that shame is to realise that you're not alone and that this is something that happens to a lot of people. This is a situation that a lot of people in the UK are in.
When you started, when you decided, right, I'm going to pay back my debt, this is what I want to achieve. How did you do it? What were the steps that you took to start to make that change? Because I mean, I for one know this, and I think lots of other people feel like this, which is we look at it and we go, it's so insurmountable. I almost don't even know where to start.
Absolutely. And I mean, this isn't the first thing that I did. This happened slower for me, but the thing that I would say to anybody who feels like they're it's insurmountable is to try and take some steps to sort of isolate it a little bit. And for me, I had very much absorbed like all £27,000 of that debt into my opinion of myself and my self-worth. And I think that can make it seem like it's part of your identity and that you'll always be in this situation and there's no way out of it. And that, you know, that's leading to some real problems. Martin Lewis's charity did a study that said that 100,000 people per year in the UK attempt suicide because of problem debt. And I think a lot of that is through feeling trapped and feeling like this is your final destination. But in terms of practically, at the beginning, I had been petrified to check my bank account or any of my credit card accounts for a long time. So that was the first step for me, was being armed with those facts. Because once you know what the situation is, it might be scary, but it's not the monster under the bed anymore. You know what it is, you know what the lay of the land is, and you can start putting in place the measures to turn things around. And along with that, I think goes talking to somebody. So whether that's your partner, whether it's a friend or family member that you trust and know won't judge you, or whether it's a charity like Step Change or Christians Against Poverty, who, you know, you can talk to at any point. You don't have to commit to any of their resolution programs. You can just talk to them. Because once you get it off your chest, trust. And once you have spoken to somebody else about it, it really, you know, that sort of age-old thing of a problem shared is a problem halved. And I think that really the relief of talking to somebody about it, if you've been keeping it to yourself, worrying about it alone for a long time, is really helpful, not just in terms of your well-being, but in terms of being able to take practical steps to sort things out.
What did you learn along the way that was maybe a revelation for you, or that you hadn't realised was possible, or that you were like, oh, this is something very easy that if only I'd thought about it earlier?
I think, a big sort of myth that's been busted for me is that, you know, sort of earning more money is the solution to being financially secure, because, you know, it really isn't. I get messages all the time from people earning a six-figure salary who have, you know, an amount of debt that frightens them. And the thing is that the more you earn, the more you can be lent against your salary. So that's, for me, the sort of the idea that actually there has to be some groundwork and you have to know your means in order to live within them rather than just chasing a higher salary all the time was really big for me. But also the thing that I've really learned to do, and the thing that I think will help a lot of people, is to talk to your bank or talk to your creditors. You know, I always felt like I would be judged by whatever advisor on the phone if I told them that I was struggling or that I was trying to pay back my balance, but that the interest was really an impediment. But actually, I mean, not all creditors are as helpful as one another. You know, some are more helpful than others. But if you can bring yourself to have that conversation, often, you know, they might be able to decrease your interest rate. I was given, you know, a couple of months interest free on one of my bigger balances just as a gesture of goodwill. And I think for a lot of people, actually, just those little gestures of kindness and sort of little financial boosts can be like the catalyst that you need to make those changes.
Well, I think, as you say, it kind of reminds you that you're not worthless just because you have some debt, that actually people understand it, that it's not something to be ashamed of, that people can have empathy and a desire to help you with it.
Yeah, and it's a bit like what you were talking about before. You know, it's something that feels really huge and embarrassing for you, but you know, once you speak to a professional, you realize they see that this stuff all the time, like going to your GP with an embarrassing problem. You know, it's their job to try and help you find a solution. And I would also say that, you know, you don't know what's going on in their life either. I get messages from people who work in finance all the time who really struggle with their own personal finance. I think it's really different.
And finally, if you could tell one thing to someone listening to this today who is struggling with their debt or is worried about it, what would you tell them?
I would just say, you know, you're not alone in this. This is a real problem in the UK, in part thanks to, you know, decades of really ruthless credit marketing. And, you know, a lot of people find themselves in the same situation. There's always, always a way through. And it absolutely does not define who you are as a person.
Thank you. Claire, thank you so much for talking to us. Thank you for your brilliant Instagram account. Anyone who, if you are in debt and you need somebody to feel a little bit reassured by, I can thoroughly recommend My Frugal Year, Claire Seal there on Instagram, and her new book, Real Money, which is out now. I actually recommended it to loads of my friends. They've all gone and bought it and they all say it's brilliant. So...
Thank you for listening to Badass Women's Hour. You can hear us every Saturday on Talk Radio from 7 p.m. for a full 3 hours, yes, 3 hours, of opinion, debate and general setting the world to rights. Now, let's get back to our guest.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Now we are talking to Dr. Alison McGregor about why gender is so important and gender and sex so important when it comes to our health. Did you know, in fact, that over 80% of drugs that are recalled from the market are done so because they haven't been properly tested on women first? Did you know that? That is the case. She's here to tell us why it is that we are still treating all medical testing as though it's only men that exist. Hi, Alison.
Hi, Harriet. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us. So tell us first, your new book, Sex Matters, says that it's really important that we talk about sex in terms of how men and women are treated in the medical when they go and see a medical professional. I didn't think it was different. I thought we all got the same treatment. What's happening?
Yes, exactly. So we now know that men and women are very different, but this was not recognized or accommodated for in the medical system. And there have been serious consequences for women because of this, and we need to do better.
What are some of those consequences?
Well, women have worse outcomes when it comes to many of the common serious conditions like heart attacks, and stroke and infections. And part of the issue is that we have not taken into account the fact that men and women have different genetic biology. So women have 2X chromosomes, so they have double copies and different immune-related genes. And men have 1X chromosome and a Y, so they have the XY. And we were taught that these chromosomes were merely responsible for deciding whether you received ovaries or testicles. And then that was it. But what we've realized is that these chromosomes are in every cell in the body, and they determine how you manifest cardiac disease or strokes or how you metabolize medications. And so we have relied upon the male model in our research and in our entire building of our medical system and our health and understanding of disease. And the consequence has been that we don't understand what it is really for women.
One of the things I thought was really interesting about your book is what happens when women describe their pain and the response they get to that. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Pain is very complicated, and because there's the biological information of something that's painful, and then there's the sort of cultural expression of pain. And so culturally, women have expressed pain and felt as though they can do so, and there's some anxiety related to it, and there's this understanding that there's a social cultural expectation. But women have lower pain thresholds, and they're always saying that they have higher pain ratings. They're more prone to painful conditions like migraine or fibromyalgia or irritable bowel syndrome. These are conditions that are really not understood. And so when they don't fit into a certain category that we've been taught during medical school, women are less likely to be treated for these painful conditions. They're more likely to be given medications that were not tested in women, so they have greater side effects. And so this is a problem that runs deep.
And is sex the only problem that we see here, or are there other groups that we are not, I guess, allocating research and time to as well?
Well, there's the two major, concepts of biological sex. So there's two genetic people of male and female, but there's something called intersex, which is, you know, where you don't have either an XX or an XY, you have some sort of combination of there. And then if you think at the hormones, whether you take them because you want to transition or you're taking them for hormone replacement therapy, all of these conditions are so far from the medical realm of study. I mean, we haven't even been studying women, never mind all of the conditions and all of the non-binary variability that's out there and growing. And so we really need to include subjects in clinical human research where the hormone status is, where they are in their cycles. Are they taking anything, exogenously, we say, either by, a pill or through a shot. So, that's the complexity we need to get to.
All the things that women can do to counteract some of the, some of the perhaps preconceived ideas that the medical profession might have, or some of the lack or failing in research that's out there?
Yes, absolutely. There is definitely a role for women to play here. And it's important to keep in mind that when they see a physician or some healthcare provider, it's not necessarily a purposeful bias. It's ingrained into the way that the system was developed. So I really empower women to take control, ownership of their own medical record and the accuracy of it. You know, we used to have the big binder, you know, when you saw your physician, it would, you know, it continued to grow. And now we have electronic medical records. And there's a lot of copy and pasting. There's different hospitals that use different systems. And so making sure that it is accurate. If you've had a condition that you feel as though hasn't been diagnosed correctly, and you've had CAT scans and ultrasounds and MRIs and all these testing, make sure that you have all of that data with you, so that way you can have an informed decision with your healthcare provider. Ask lots of questions. Ask them if the medication that they've prescribed to you was based on your biological sex. And are there any side effects that you should be aware of because of that? These are all the things that I try to empower women through this book and then through my clinical practice to do.
Do you think that there is something to be said for women actually being a little bit more dictatorial in terms of what gets put into their notes? Because I was thinking about an experience I had probably about 10 years ago now, where I had been to see my doctor. I'd been feeling very unwell for several weeks, and I'd been to see my doctor. I was feeling unwell, I was tired, I was slightly at the end of my tether, and I felt very much like I was being dismissed by him, that he was sort of just saying, oh, well, you know, what you're experiencing, it's just because you're a bit stressed. And because I was feeling unwell and I was a bit stressed, I burst into tears, and I noticed him writing in my notes, shows sign of depression. And I said, no, I'm not depressed. I'm frustrated. You know, I'm crying because I'm angry and I'm tired and I want a solution to this. Please don't put in my notes that I'm showing signs of depression when that's not what's going on here. It's something else entirely. And
I know exactly what you're describing. I really do. It's that exact thing. And the most common, past medical history we list is anxiety and depression. And almost all women have that listed that I see in the emergency department. And I wonder, they don't meet the official criteria for a generalized anxiety disorder or a major depressive disorder. Sometimes one physician or healthcare provider can just sort of list that, and then that's what gets carried on and on and on. And then many women, unlike yourself, start to feel like, well, perhaps I am depressed or perhaps I am anxious. And so then when they see another doctor, they offer that up as a reason for the fact that they're not feeling well. Well, it could be my anxiety. And so I really feel as though a couple things that can women can do is to bring in advocates. I know in this COVID times, it's not very welcoming to have lots of people there, but you could have them be on the phone or just listen. Because oftentimes, if the person, you know, if you're not feeling well, you may feel emotional about the fact that you're not feeling well. It doesn't mean that you're emotional. It means that you're not feeling well. And so by having an advocate there that can say, look, she doesn't normally have anxiety. There's something wrong. She's, you know, this is unusual. And then clearly state your motives for the visit. So if your motive is to get a diagnosis, or if your motive is to just get some relief, or just to discuss some things that you didn't understand at the specialist office, this will help you feel as though that you will get what you need from that office visit.
And speaking of COVID-19 and these kind of strange times that we're living in, do you think we know that, you know, potentially men are more likely to suffer severely from COVID-19, they're more likely to die from it? Do you think this is because we are talking about this very early on now, that perhaps this is the start of us actually looking at gender in medicine more widely, that we talk about it, talk about gender, that we talk about ethnicity, that we talk about age as part of the routine of medicine as opposed to something that gets tacked on at the end?
I really honestly hope so. I mean, this pandemic has shown us, you know, some real fault lines in medicine, and it's demonstrating that biological sex is in fact an important issue. And when you look at a 2x mortality rate of men over women, it begs the question of why. And so is it the immune? Is it the presence of testosterone or the lack of estrogen? Is it, you know, bad patterns of behavior? And so I think the fact that men have the higher mortality rates or this condition will bring to light the fact that this isn't just a women's health issue, you know, that this is an issue of science and in equity and as we're working very hard to fast track important medications and therapies and vaccines, we must include both men and women and design the studies to determine if there's any difference, to see if there's important differences that exist.
Yeah. And finally, Alison, if you could give sort of, if there was one condition or one piece of medical information that you would want women to be aware of that maybe they present differently with, or that this doesn't get picked up in them as much, is there something that as women we should be aware of that if it happens to us, it is going to look different in us and we might have to explain that to our doctors?
Absolutely. And the ones that we know most about, you know, keeping in mind that there's a lot of unknown here, is heart attacks, you know, and strokes. And so women have, if you think about those chromosomes, XX, inside their heart muscle are different genes that are being turned on. They develop disease differently, and they're going to present with a heart attack not the typical way that we've been taught. And all of us have been taught. So women are at home and waiting for the crushing chest pain and not seeking care, because we've said that heart attacks feel like an elephant sitting on your chest. And then there's the delay when they actually seek care because the providers aren't recognizing it. And this goes on and on and on. And so I would really encourage women that if they don't feel right, and, you know, there's a lot of information out there. The evidence is increasing exponentially. And so to feel as though doing research online is a positive thing to do, so you can have an informed conversation and maybe even teach your doctor how you may be unique.
Fabulous. Thank you so much for joining us, Alison. Dr. Alison McGregor, author there of Sex Matters, talking about why it is that when it comes to our medical history, when it comes to our health, we do have to take our sex into consideration. We have to think about the fact that a lot of drugs have been tested on men, they haven't been tested on women, that women present with different symptoms for the same illnesses as men, and that actually men and women have different outcomes. We're really seeing that right now with coronavirus. We're seeing that your sex matters for what could happen to you when you get ill. We need to talk about it at all levels of medicine.
You've been listening to Badass Women's Hour. If you like the show, then help more people find us. You can tag us or talk to us on social media using @BadassWomen'sHour. Or you can be really lovely and leave us a review and a rating. 5 stars, please. It helps boost us up the podcast rankings and allows other people to find us. We'll be back next week with more badass guests and in-depth chat.
Hey folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.